in one of his many books, our next guest once wrote, "There is no bad weather, only inappropriate clothing." Sir Ranulph Twistleton Wickham Fiennes, OBE, is the third Baronet of Banbury and perhaps the world's greatest contemporary explorer. He's coming to Auckland to be the keynote speaker at the Himalayan Trust Gala Dinner in Auckland next month. And its founder, Sir Edmund Hillary, would have turned 100 on July the 20th. Ranulph Fiennes is a British expedition leader. He's 75 years old and going strong. There have been several heart attacks, a double heart bypass, a cancer operation, and diabetes and scoliosis, which may have resulted from towing 220-kilogram sledges across long stretches of frozen terrain. His adventures are just too numerous to summarise, but they include being thrown out of the SAS for naughtiness with explosives, dangerous counter-insurgency service while in the employ of the Sultan of Oman. He was the first adventurer to visit both poles by travelling on the surface of the earth and the first to completely cross Antarctica on foot. Sir Ranulph Fiennes joins us. Good morning, although I understand you don't like being addressed as Sir Ranulph, so how should we address you?
Most people call me Ran. Obviously, my mother, when she was not happy, came up with the full Ranulph, but Ran is normal.
We find you on your farm in Exmoor?
Correct, yep, in southwest UK.
Down the bottom across the water from Wales?
Yeah, if you climb up to the field where the cows are and you look on a good day, you can see Cardiff on the other side of the water.
Ah, really? I haven't been there, but they say it's very pretty.
I love it, yep. It's sort of like parts of Scotland, heather and all that.
We tend to think of you as ceaselessly restless and always on the move, but are you quite happy pottering around the farm as well?
I'm very lucky because there's a wonderful bloke who looks after the cattle and the sheep. But 15 years ago, when my late wife died, she did all that herself, looked after all the cattle. And the ones that are there now are the great-grandchildren of her animals. Everything was black, the black sheep, the black cows, her dogs, which she brought back from the Arctic and used to interbreed with Labradors and then sell. Black dogs, we called them. They were St. John water dogs from Canada, and they were all black. Her cats were black. I was just about the only non-black on allowed.
I know you dislike being called the world's greatest living explorer, which is what the Guinness Book of Records bequeathed on you way, way back. What would you call yourself?
In my passport for the last 40 years, it has and still does say travel writer.
Travel writer doesn't seem to do you justice. I mean, I know you have published 25 books, many of them about intrepid travels to inhospitable places, but you are more than a travel... Well, I shouldn't really get you to comment because you're modest, but all right, let's just stick with the explorer moniker, if I may. You've done and seen things most people will only ever read about. Can I ask you, from the get-go, have those experiences changed you? I imagine they have, but also the way you regard the human race and our place on the planet and how we are doing?
Yeah, I'm not sort of very philosophical or introspective or generally very good at comments of a huge, wide nature like that. But in terms of the actual people that we've looked at, we being my late wife and myself, because she was into the expeditions, and behind them. And we looked very carefully at people. On one occasion, there were 800 applicants for one of our expeditions, and they only wanted two of them. So we looked very, very carefully and took a long time before we finally took them on. We made sure that all of them knew that they would never be paid anything, not even expenses, for being involved in the expeditions. So unlike, shall we say, Shackleton, who paid people on his ship's crews, we, for instance, on our ship's crew, we had three engineers who were from New Zealand, and none of them got paid anything at all. And we had the second officer on the ship, who for 4 years, John Parslow from New Zealand, basically one of the best New Zealand DSIR captains, very experienced at ICE. And again, he, John Parslow, got nothing for all the years that he was with us. And so there wasn't any financial motive, which is a good thing. And it meant that we didn't get into debt like poor old Shackleton did.
Mm.
Yeah, and we looked very, very carefully, as I say, at their characters. So we looked to make sure that the people going on the land expeditions, or ICE if you want to call it that, were not necessarily skilled. Their characters were what we were looking at, because after all, you can teach skills. You can't really change characters. And we ended up with 2 out of 800, and we were very happy with our choice.
So you obviously have a fondness for New Zealanders, don't you?
Yeah, and I mean, Aussies and Kiwis are something that have just turned up on all the expeditions, much more than the others. There are, on one expedition, there were 9 different countries represented, but in terms of the most of them, they were Kiwis.
You're in New Zealand to speak at the Himalayan Trust Gala Dinner in Auckland on July 17. The Trust, of course, was founded by Sir Ed Hillary back in 1960. What are your memories of Sir Ed as a mountaineer and a person, Ran?
Well, I obviously never actually sadly met him. The nearest I got to meeting him was one day in the Alps with a friend just walking in the mountains. We came across a load of gentlemen older than us, but in shorts with sticks. And one of them was called John Hunt, and he was the sort of leader of the expedition, which ended up with Ed Hillary and Tenzing on the summit. So I was very honored to meet him, but sadly never met the great man himself, Ed Hillary. But I've been a fan and devotee of his for as many years as I can remember.
You select 2 out of 800. How do you regard, can I ask you, how do you regard the rest of humanity who are far less intrepid than you? Because you stand apart, and presumably those 2 in every 800 stand apart too.
Well, that's, very kind of you to say something like that. But we regard humanity as just that. It is humanity. It comes in 1,000 or 1,000,000 different shapes and sizes. We are all what we got born with, DNA and so on. And we make do with what we got, you know, when we came out of the cradle. And thank, or don't thank, our parents and ancestors as a result. In terms of my wanting to do something when I grew up, I only wanted to be like my dad, who was killed 4 months before I was born in the war. But he was in charge of a great Scottish regiment that did incredibly well at the Battle of Alamein and later at Salerno. He was wounded 5 times badly. He was killed eventually not long before Monte Cassino during the liberation of Naples. And that's what I wanted to be, like him, colonel of that same Scottish regiment. But partly because my first 12 years or so were spent in South Africa, because after Dad died, his mum, who was South African, wanted to go back there and took my sisters and my mother. So that was 12 years. And when I got back to the UK, I think my academic standards were a bit lower, and I therefore couldn't pass the exams in the UK, which meant I couldn't go to Sandhurst Officers College, which meant I couldn't end up doing what I wanted to do all those years. And so when I was 24, I finally accepted that I couldn't and would have to make money somehow else.
Yes. I've read about your dad. I just want to ask you one more thing about your motivations, because I've read something that you said about being born with an impulse for what you do. I interviewed 2 New Zealanders who'd won the Victoria Cross in Greece and Crete, Charles Upham and Jack Hinton. And Jack Hinton, against orders, charged 2 machine gun nests and armed with grenades and a bayonet. It was an amazing display of courage. Charles Upham said he had never felt fear Jack Hinton said he was more or less scared all the time. Where are you on that sort of continuum? Because you've done amazing things yourself. How much have you had to overcome that kind of fear that Jack Hinton talked about?
I haven't ever sort of charged machine guns knowingly, except at night in Arabia against the communists. So I don't really know about charging machine guns by day with grenades and so on. So I can't comment on that. But in terms of fear, yeah, I mean, being driven in a minivan by my wife is sort of frightening. I'm not in control. But on the expeditions, we do try to avoid taking risks because our enemy, the Norwegians, who go for the same goals to break the same polar records, we've just look at why they've failed at some of their attempts in the past, and it's usually because they've taken a risk. So we, when we plan, try to avoid those risks rather than go over them. We try to go around them and avoid being frightened.
You talk about the care you take, and I'm sure that's correct, but you also seem to have a wonderfully reckless streak as well. There was that spell in the SAS where you specialised in explosives and reportedly tried to blow up a dam that had been built by a movie studio. You got into trouble for that.
Yeah, I mean, that was the idea of a person I'd been at school with who had been a very good friend, and he decided that it would be a good idea to blow up a concrete dam, which 20th Century Fox, who are making a film, in a village in South England, which had been voted the prettiest village in Europe. And having it ruined by this dam, he, this friend who had become a wine salesman, and when he was selling wine down in this village, he heard the villagers complaining about it. And he thought, well, they're not doing anything about it. We will, on their behalf, complain by blowing up the dam. And he knew that I had recently completed an explosives course, and I had been quite good at it. And the whole point of the army instruction was that you should use blow up as much as you can with as little as possible. And I've been quite good at this, so I had a lot left over at the end of every training day. So I sort of had it, and a good way of getting rid of it.
That was for the movie Dr. Dolittle?
It was.
Right. But they took a dim view of that, but you avoided jail, put it that way.
Well, at the assizes, when the four of us were up in the dock, frightened of a jail sentence, the judge gave us very heavy fines, but because it wasn't criminal, it was sort of, you know, for a reason, we didn't get put in jail. 15 years later, I met him in a hospital. He was dying, the judge, and he said, by the way, 15 years ago when I summoned you in the court, I would have had to give you 7 years in jail minimum if you'd done it a year later, because a year later the IRA, Irish, started blowing up things in mainland Britain and explosives became a more serious problem.
Ah. Skin of your teeth.
Yep.
Look, you've summited Everest at an age where most people in New Zealand are getting what we call the gold card. I don't need to tell you what you've done back to you, but I mean, circumnavigating the world across its polar axis and crossing the Antarctic unsupported and 7 marathons and 7 continents in 7 days. Is there anything you haven't achieved ever that you badly wanted to?
Yeah, 3 years ago with Dr. Michael Stroud, with whom I've been doing expeditions for 30 years, we intended to cross Antarctica during the polar winter, a 3-month period. And because all governments, including Kiwi and British, don't let their citizens into the interior during the winter months, we had to not ski and manhaul in the normal way. We would have to have all sorts of things like they have in British Antarctic Survey bases or Scott base, the New Zealand base, which is, for instance, an operating theatre for appendix. Well, if you're skiing across, you can't carry that with you. So we ended up having to take two 25-ton caterpillars which towed ship containers on skis, which did have all the things on the government lists, and they eventually allowed us to go. Standard Chartered had a ship. We had a big charity for the blind that we were raising money for. We had scientific people, an ex-British Antarctic Survey doctor and so on. And we failed. We ran into a crevasse field which the satellite photographs hadn't pointed out. And the scientists in these ship's containers then spent 8 months of the winter up above on 11,000 feet, but we never crossed. We got as far as the crevasse field, and that was it. That was because the 25-ton caterpillars were so heavy that they would locate crevasses, which skiing you never would.
Okay, so that's a big regret. In terms of triumphs, that 24-year search of yours for the lost city of Ubar in the Arabian Desert, which you managed in 1992... was that your biggest achievement among enormous achievements?
It certainly was the one that took longest. And, you know, we had excitements when we thought we'd found traces of it. And then the excitements turned out to be wrong and that it wasn't what we were looking for. And after five attempts, we started in 1968, eventually found it in the early 90s. On the fifth attempt, I sort of gave up and I told Ginny, who spoke good Arabic, that, you know, we're wasting our time. We'd never find it. But she was determined that we would, so we carried on. And on the eighth attempt, out of more good luck than clever archaeological work, we did find it. And it's now probably one of the biggest excavation works in Arabia.
I know, it was a marvellous discovery and a tribute to perseverance. But you're not short of that. Speaking of your then-wife, Ginny, she complained once that you were becoming irritable from frostbite pain. This was back in 2000, and you are famous for cutting off the tips of your fingers and a thumb.
Yeah, the doctors were going to amputate the frozen ends of the five fingers, and they refused to do the operation until 5 months after the accident, after the trauma. So for 5 months, wandering around on this farm, with every time the mummified ends touch something, is really quite painful, where the dead meets the live open ends of the five fingers, like Gestapo. And so it's very difficult not to touch things by mistake, particularly at night when you're trying to sleep. And I suppose I was getting a bit irritable and couldn't wait 5 months. So Ginny, who does or did clip the hooves of the Aberdeen Angus with clippers, said, why not clip the dead bits off the end of the fingers? Then they won't stick out and touch things. Then you won't get irritable. And I said, well, you know, blood and pain. She said, well, if where you cut is bleeding or is painful, just move the saw, the cutting blade, further into the dead stuff, which made sense. So we bought a Black & Decker workbench and a fret saw, and Ginny bought me cups of tea. The thumb actually took 2 days to get through because of the sort of big bone, but I got rid of all of them without pain, and the physiotherapist in Bristol said I'd done a good job.
Your father was a very brave man. He would be, because I presume you've thought of this over the years, he would be proud of you.
Well, that's very kind of you to say so. I would have loved to have taken over the job, as I say, of colonel of that wonderful regiment, and then made him really proud. Whether or not he's proud of the expeditions, I can't say, but I try not, if I am tempted to give up on a particular expedition, I do think that he's watching, and I wouldn't want to, that helps me not give up.
The Royal Scots Greys, excuse my ignorance, but aren't they one of the great regiments? Didn't they charge at Waterloo?
They did, and they managed to get Napoleon's flag, standard.
Right.
And they copied the eagle badge from the standard and made it into their own regimental badge.
All this bravery, which we've discussed some of, can I ask you about the state of the world now. I know you don't like to get too philosophical, as you've said, but are we somehow less intrepid? In Mad, Bad and Dangerous to Know, you wrote, famously, that a committee is a group of people who individually can do nothing and as a group decide nothing can be done, which is a tremendously wonderful quote. Are we more like that now, or are we as intrepid as we ever were? What do you think?
I think that individuals in every country are just as this, that and the other as they always were. I don't see whether it's intrepidness or laziness or whatever that it actually changes whatever country you come from.
Okay. So it's still in us. It's certainly still in people like you. You once said you would like to raise £20 million for good causes in your lifetime. Any idea where the tally sits today, Ran?
Yeah, that's an unfortunate nagging fact. It sort of got stuck at 18.9. And if Mike Stroud and I don't get something going again soon, we'll never get to 20.
I have a feeling you will, because you're still relatively young in modern terms. And how's the body holding up?
Well, apart from the fact that as of the Marathon des Sables race in the desert, I think 3 years ago, my torch battery went and I stumbled into a hole and twisted the sort of glutes and things. And ever since then, my body's not been straight. So when you go for your daily run, you're sort of leaning forward and you're off to one side and it's very annoying.
So what's ahead for you in the years ahead? What are you planning?
There's four possibilities and none of them have got sponsorship yet. One of them is in South Africa and it's basically underwater. One of them is in the Arctic, one of them is in the Antarctic, and one of them is in British Columbia. And we don't know if any of them will work out, but we are sort of working on the planning.
This is the walk along the seabed from Robben Island, where Nelson Mandela was imprisoned, to Cape Town?
For 27 years in prison, yeah.
Yes, yes. So that'll be, if you do that one, which I don't know how that works, but it sounds fantastic. You spent your childhood in Cape Town. That would be reasonably close to your heart. Part of your childhood was spent down there.
Yeah, that's correct. On the beach at St. James's near Cape Town for 2 years, and then under Table Mountain, a little bit away from Cape Town, for 8 or 9 years. And it was a great place to be brought up. I went to four schools out there.
So you're planning all sorts of things. If there's one thing you'd like to see people doing more of or being more proactive about as you look around the world, what would it be?
It would definitely be getting a move on with all aspects of climate change and plastic in the water and so on.
Okay. You've also said that pessimism is your worst quality. We know about your great qualities. You said that pessimism is your worst one. You would think that's not ideal for a great expedition leader. So how does that work in terms of the way you live your life?
Well, I usually have somebody close who is optimistic, and the result of the two things put together is usually realism.
But you've got boundless enthusiasm. It's interesting. So, all right, but you never let it go to your head, obviously. I suppose that's one result of that.
I think it's a bad mistake ever letting things, to use our old saying of going to your head. Yeah, that's going to cause disappointment usually.
What will you talk about in New Zealand, may I ask? Do you have a theme yet?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'll talk about the great man and what he sort of did and how wonderful it must be. And also, I hopefully meet his great son, Peter.
Yes. I know you're both on the same stage together. Can I ask you a final question? We could have talked about, and I've used the word intrepid a lot in this chat. We could have talked about any number of your adventures. Of the intrepid ones, was there a favourite? Has there been a favourite looking back?
I think if intrepid has got to do with being frightened, it would definitely be the 2 years in the army in Dhofar, South Oman.
Okay. That was when you ran the most risks and maybe were in most peril.
I think so.
One thing I forgot to ask you, if you don't mind, before we go. You reached Everest on the third attempt. And I wonder two things. Actually, what you think of the queues on the mountain now, which you may have seen in recent photographs. I don't know what your opinion of that is.
Well, I think it would be really frightening to be in a queue like that.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that you would never have encountered. But do you think it's also...
Well, you know, every minute that you're there waiting and you're looking at the vast queue ahead and the ropes, you know, it would help if there were two ropes, one to go up and one to go down.
Yeah.
I would be very frightened because as the minutes are ticking by, you're losing your oxygen.
And we can see the effect of that in some of the fatalities, I think. The other part of that question was, would you still be trying to climb Everest if you hadn't managed it on the third attempt, speaking of perseverance? Would you still be giving it a go?
I don't know, because that's like saying after my second attempt, would I do a third? For a bit, I probably might have said no and then changed my mind. but the reason I managed to get up a third time was purely because the Sherpa was just brilliant and he understood what I was doing wrong. Tundu Sherpa, he was just great. Sadly, he died in an avalanche last year, but it was him that got me up there on the third go.
Congratulations on your adventure so far. Very lovely of you to talk to us, and we so look forward to your being out in New Zealand.
Look forward to seeing you then, Jim. Cheers.
Sir Ranulph Fiennes.